Priebus is from Andrews University, and Peter and I have had the privilege of getting acquainted on the General Conference Nutrition Council. Peter is very involved. He's part of the health and nutrition, or wellness and nutrition department at Andrews University, and we're delighted that you're here, Peter. You're back home in Europe.
Right.
And he is originally from Slovakia. And I think you're going there next week.
Yes, I am.
But tell us all about gene expression and its relationship to health determinants. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Fred. We communicate with Fred on a different venue because we are the only two Nutrition Council members who have MEC. And as you kind of know, the MEC culture sticks thicker than family. Anyway, I would like to give you a brief overview of research, which when I first read it, I almost got goosebumps because it was so exciting. And actually, Dr. Wes Youngberg already spoke about it yesterday. So what I'm going to do is I'm basically just going to explain more what was actually discovered in the last few years. Now, first of all, I would like to start with explaining to you what is the word epigenetics. And as it says there, epigenetic refers to changes in phenotype, which is our appearance, caused by other mechanisms than changes in a DNA sequence. With other words, what they are trying to say is that, as the word says, epigenetics, it's in addition to genetics. Now, let me just step one step back and explain to you. This is what I remember when I was in med school, which they drilled and grilled into us, that everything was caused by mutation. And this is an example here. You have chromosomes who were exposed to high level of X-ray, and you see that actually some of the pieces of the chromosomes have broken off. So actually what happened is that there was a loss of genetic information. Or sometimes what actually happens is that in the genetic information, in the DNA sequence, there is a mistake. And a classical example, for example, is sickle cell anemia, where we know that there is only one base switched. And of course, this one switch causes that the erythrocytes look like sickle cells, and therefore the people are severely handicapped. Now, what I'm going to talk about in epigenetics goes beyond, of course, mutation. And, of course, there is another genetic code. And this code is capable of doing transgenerational, actually, effects. And this goes actually back to Lamarck, which was actually talking about this. And for many years, actually, we did not believe him. Now, generally speaking, I remember in the old days it was always environment versus genes. And so on one side we have environmental changes or effects, and they were basically considered non-genetic. So things like, for example, nutrition, smoking, you know, this was considered as a non-genetic effect. And then, of course, they were inheritable effects or considered genetic. And classical example would be, for example, color blindness or cystic fibrosis. You are born with a gene who causes cystic fibrosis. This is a genetic disease. Now, as we have actually learned, actually this dogma is very simplistic and definitely inaccurate. Now, what we have learned through epigenetics is that actually genes can be turned off or on, and this can happen transgenerationally, which means across generations. And basically you can start your life with a gene turned on, or you can start your life with a gene turned off. And it simply depends what the one who gives the gene does. So for example, if a man smokes and then he conceives a child, because of his smoking he already tampered with his DNA. And now the DNA is given to the woman, and actually the child already starts life with a compromised DNA because the genes are turned off and off on differently, as in a man who did not smoke and gave the DNA in a much better condition. Actually, this also brings a great question, and actually in the United States they have been books written about it, about genetic testing. Because if we test your gene, your DNA, and we discover that you have a gene for a rare disease, well, it's irrelevant to have the gene. What is relevant is whether the gene is turned off or turned on, whether expressed or suppressed, because this actually decides whether you are going to get the disease or not to get the disease. And I can absolutely assume that if any of us here would have his DNA tested, we would discover all kinds of unpleasant genes, which we are not happy about. But the issue is not to have the genes. The issue is to have the genes turned off. Now, there is many things, actually, which we still do not even understand in genetics. For example, we do not understand why chromosomes look like they look. Is there a particular reason that to the structure of the chromosome? Maybe you have read that the DNA on the chromosome is actually layered into loops. We also don't understand why is it looped, you know, and why this, what kind of function has this three-dimensional structure. We are starting to understand, however, two mechanisms, and one is the histones and one is the methylation. And this is actually what I'm going to talk more about. Now, the histones, these are proteins who are actually attached like balls to the DNA. And actually, the histones decide whether your gene will be turned on or turned off. So the gene itself, well, you have a gene, but it's the histone who decides whether your gene will be active or not active. And the second mechanism which was discovered is called methylation. And again, the methylation of the DNA decides whether certain genes will be expressed or suppressed. Now, this is a beautiful picture of twins, identical twins. And as we would expect, their DNA, because these are identical twins, is what? Identical, right? What about these guys? Do you think that their DNA is also identical? Well, wrong. There was a wonderful study done in Spain. And what they did is they took the DNA of a three-year-old twins and then again when they were 50 years old. And what you see here, this is actually the methylation, the differences in the gene expression. And as you can see, is when they were 3 years old, this looks pretty much very identical. But as the life progresses, maybe one smoked, maybe one didn't smoke. Maybe one lived in a country, the other lived in a city. Maybe one ate vegetables, the other didn't eat vegetables. So what happened in this is that their different genes got turned off or on. They had a different methylation, and you can see it here. Here it is expressed also in a more graphical way. Now, if you look here at this picture, this is actually even more fascinating. This is chromosome 16, 17, 19, and 20. And everything what you see on the picture, which is red, is actually marked the differences in methylation. So you see when they were 3 years old, you see very little differences in red. Now when they are 50 years old, suddenly you see that the chromosomes differ to the great degree because, you know, as I said, you know, they live in different conditions and therefore they have expressed or suppressed the different genes. Now, everything what I talked about up till now is just a preparation to explain you now this wonderful study which I have discovered. It was published in 2005 by Dean Ornish. Now, what he did is in San Francisco, he enrolled 93 people, 44 in the experimental group and 49 into the control group. And all those were men who had actually prostate cancer. Now, the reason why he chose prostate cancer is because this is a cancer which is very slowly growing. And actually, in most cases, sometimes when people have, when men have autopsy, they die maybe of a heart attack, they actually discover it as a side finding that actually they had also prostate cancer. Now, those who were eligible for the study, they need to have a Gleason grading of 7. Now, I will explain to you what this means. Gleason was an American pathologist, and actually, this is healthy prostate tissue, and this goes all the way down to unhealthy, and this is actually graded from 1 to 5. And so when they take a prostate biopsy, what they do is they stick needle into your prostate in two places. Then they look under the microscope how the tissue looks like, and then they grade it, one, two, whatever, and then they add it together. So those people had to have a Gleason grading of 7, which basically tells you that it was a beginning of prostate cancer. Then they had to have a PSA level, prostate-specific antigen level, lower than 4 to 10 nanograms. Again, it basically shows that it's an early stage of prostate cancer. And then they had to all be in a T1 or T2 stage, which means that they only the prostate was affected. So there was no lymph nodes around the prostate, and there was also no metastasis. Now, what they did is they applied, in my opinion, a very simple lifestyle program, and they did it for 1 year. So the diet was basically a vegan diet, which was supplemented with soy, as you can see, one daily serving of tofu or fortified soya protein powder. Now, he also gave them a lot of supplements. He gave them a fish oil every day, vitamin E, selenium, and vitamin. As you can see, all of them are actually antioxidants. Now, the diet which the people were required to eat was basically made out of fruits and vegetables, whole grain, legumes, soya products, and it was very, very low in fat. Only 10% of calories were allowed from fat. Now, we could debate whether this is good or not, because, of course, 10% means that they were not allowed even things which are very healthy, like, for example, nuts or avocados or anything which contained basically fat. And last thing, because it was a comprehensive lifestyle change, they were required to walk every day 30 minutes, which actually on 6 days per week, so they could sleep in on Sunday. They were required to do stress management every day, and he was totally inclusive. It was up to them. What are they going to do? It could be prayer and meditation. It could be yoga. And then they had to participate in a one-hour support group once per week, which is social support. And this was all what they had to do basically for 1 year. Now, this is the baseline characteristics of the people, and you can see that there was basically very or non-significant differences between the two groups. So they were pretty much similar. And I am going just to show you selected results from the study because I don't have time, unfortunately. So this is the changes in PSA levels. And I mean, this is from 5 to 8. It doesn't go from 0, okay? And so the difference was very little. But what you can see is this is the experimental group. This is the group which actually did the treatment. And you can see that it's from 6.23 to 5.98. Basically, you would describe it as a no change, right? State. But you can see that actually the control group went up. So what actually what the treatment was able to do is it was maybe not able to totally regress the cancer, but was able to at least stop the progression. Now, this is totally interesting what they did. They took the serum from the people, and in the Petri dish, they took cancer cells, prostate cancer cells, and put them into the serum of the people, and they watched whether these cells can multiply, they can grow. And they have discovered that this is the group, this is the experimental group, okay, with the lifestyle treatment. And you can see that only 9% of the cases, actually, the prostate cancer were able to grow. And here, in 70%. So it's quite clear that actually the serum from those who were in the lifestyle treatment contained something which was able to stop or at least not promote cancer growth. Now, again, this is something which was true for the first study with Dean Ornish, which he did with heart disease, is that the strongest indicator whether people profited from this was adherence. So adherence basically means whether they were really closely following what he told them to do. And you see that actually those who had a very low adherence, well, they didn't take it so seriously. Actually, they had an 8% increase in PSA. Those who took it medium, you know, it's a good idea, I will do it, they had a 2% increase. And actually, those who took it really seriously, they adhered to the program, they had actually a 5% decrease in PSA. Now, they, of course, all experienced a whole array of interesting side effects. They lost weight, their total cholesterol went down, the LDL cholesterol went down, the HDL cholesterol went down, the triglycerides went a little bit up. So something which actually was observed already during the heart trial. If this is exciting news, what I'm going to tell you now is super, super, super exciting. Out of this study came the geminal part of the study. And now what they did is they took the biopsies from the people, they took an 18 gag needle, and they took biopsy from the prostate at the beginning and after 3 months. Beginning and 3 months. And they froze it. And then out of these little tiny samples, they were actually able to get RNA. And now what they did is they used a method which is called significance analysis of microarrays, SMA, and they were able to see what genes are upregulated and downregulated. They have actually able to discover that after 3 months, only 3 months of intensive lifestyle treatment, 48 genes were upregulated, which means turned on, and 453 were turned off. Now, because we know the human genome now, we know in the human genome certain genes which are oncogenes, which are, we know, they are responsible for oncogenesis, which means that they, when they are turned on, they may lead to cancer. Now, this is just a selection of selected group of some of these genes, and you can, I don't know if you guys can see it, good, the red means that there was a quite active intercellular protein traffic, which means that the genes were turned on. And eventually here you can see it's green, which means that these genes were turned off. They were basically downregulated. Now, there is a, because of the genome project, we know that there is a RAS family of oncogenes as they are described. There is three of them. RNA, RAB14, and RABA8, and they were able to demonstrate that all three of them were downregulated. Probably this news is the most exciting news. There is a special gene which is called SHOC2, and this is a gene which is actually what he does mitogen activated protein kinase. And what it does basically, it promotes or activates all kinds of growth factors. This gene is so crucial, so important, that actually in chemotherapy, a lot of chemotherapies actually target this gene. So when you are taking chemotherapy, the chemotherapy was made so that this gene will be turned off. Guess what? What happened? This gene was downregulated. And here you can see, unfortunately, out of the 30 patients, only 14, they didn't have enough RNA. So you can see that this is actually the situation in the remaining 16 patients. Now, probably somebody might raise questions, says, how is this possible that in 4 people it was upregulated? I have no clue. But my guess is that maybe these were the people with low adherence. You know, that because of the low adherence, you know, in their case, the gene was actually not downregulated. But you can see in majority of the cases, the gene was downregulated, this crucial gene, which is actually responsible for, or is crucial in oncogenesis. And the last thing, or last gene, which I would like to point out, single, is IGF. And again, you all know about insulin-like growth factor, and we also know that insulin-like growth factor is a very strong promoter of cancer growth. And again, guess what? EGF was downregulated. So at least on 5 occasions, they were able to see how crucial oncogenes were actually able, were downregulated or turned off. Now, the geminal study provides a preliminary evidence that prostate gene expression may be modulated by diet and lifestyle. To me, this is that our lifestyle determines our fate. And with our lifestyle, we are able to tamper with our DNA and with our genes. Now, thank you for listening. But you guys are not off the hook. Now please go and spread this wonderful news.